Holding Pocket.
Welcome to another episode of The Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. So hello again, rabbit holies.
Hi, Kat.
Hello, Kat.
So we're all still away travelling this week, apart from Richard. You're still at home?
Well, I did go to Eastbourne, but that's about as far as I've gone.
That's sort of exotic, isn't it?
Not really.
I'm in North Carolina, and I'm spending time at High Point, which is the great sort of mecca for furniture manufacturers and sellers. So, yeah, I have a furniture line connected to my home and come here every now and then. And it's just millions and millions of square feet of warehouses that are asleep for 50 weeks a year and then spring alive with furniture for 2 weeks a year.
That's fascinating. So it's just everyone who seems in furniture, they gather. It's like a sort of furniture trade fair.
Yeah, it's everything, whether it's Ralph Lauren doing their things or handmade reproductions of antique furniture through to... I bumped into Jacqueline Smith, one of Charlie's Angels. I think she's got a range with Walmart or someone. So it's everyone's here.
I want to bring out furniture range now.
You should, Richard.
Well, I don't think Rabbit Hole Detectives should do a furniture line.
A Conan Doyle range.
Yeah, the Conan Doyle, the Toppy Padgett range, encrusted with, well, paste. Yeah, sounds good to me.
Does it make you want to go shopping, Charles? Do you go around and sort of find things that you want?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do. I see things that are really beautiful and much, much less expensive over here than in England. But then, of course, you'd have to ship it and pay tax. So, no, but it's lovely. I love looking at furniture, actually. It's one of my things.
Oh, I didn't know that, Charles. So can you tell the difference between a sort of Chippendale commode and a Hepplewhite bureau?
Yes. I tell you what, though, it's interesting that the way that some of the handmade stuff is so good. We've got this range called Althorp Living History. And a couple of times, Christie's have sold the reproductions by mistake in their auctions as originals. So that's how good the crafting can be now.
But where do you find people who can, with the sort of cabinet-making skills of the sort of 18th, 19th century?
Well, do you know, in the post-colonial world, in Vietnam, the French trained up cabinet makers to the very highest level. And that seems to be the place for getting proper craftsmen in a sort of, you know, in a properly regulated factory setting as opposed to a sweatshop.
Fascinating.
Charles, I have to ask you, have you ever bought anything from IKEA?
You've had a go at me on this before. I haven't. So listen, we've already established I've never visited an IKEA and I don't know. I could have bought one online, but I'm not going to reveal that. It's my secret.
Okay, fine. I'm gonna crack you one day. We're gonna drag you to IKEA, and you're gonna have meatballs, and you're gonna buy cheap tea lights and a desk or something.
Fantastic. Well, I was gonna say I can't wait, but that would be a lie.
I can't wait. Fun for me.
No, I'm full of respect for IKEA.
Okay. Good, excellent. Right, shall we get into it? Because obviously we've been revising again. I quite enjoyed my revision and learning this week because I could do it on the go, which was quite fun. So I've been looking into the Cape Verde Islands and the history of them, which is actually quite fascinating. So I didn't really know very much about these islands before I came here, but it's becoming an increasingly popular tourist destination for Europeans especially. It's a chain of 10 islands covering an area of about 4,000 square kilometres, located roughly 600-700 kilometres off the westernmost point of continental Africa by Senegal and the Gambia. Only 9 of the islands are populated. The population is about 590,000 people, I think so. But it's actually one of the most developed and democratic countries in Africa, quite surprisingly. And so although it, you can feel, you know, it's not a wealthy country, it seems to be reasonably well run and people are very happy here, which I really, really liked. It's got interesting geography, so it's volcanic origins, active volcanoes. Some of the islands, like the one I'm on at the moment, which is called Sol, is completely flat and essentially just a desert. But others have got beautiful mountainy regions and much more tropical climate. Culturally, it's got a mix. It's a former Portuguese colony, and it's got a mix of African and Portuguese ancestry in the population. Of course, the slave trade being the sort of origin of most of the settlement here, as we'll hear about in a moment. Language is Portuguese and Creole. I spoke to some of the locals here saying that actually they learn Portuguese at school, but nobody wants to speak it at all. So it's all Creole. And each different island has got its own version of it. So you can very clearly hear which island somebody comes from and how they speak. But if you go back to the origins, so the island groups were discovered in the 15th century. Prior to that, they were uninhabited. So there was no native population here. They were completely desert islands, really. And the person that is credited with the discovery is the Portuguese Henry the Navigator, who lived from 1394 to 1460. And he was essentially a great explorer and part of really what's been known as this Age of Discovery. He was the son of, third surviving son of the Portuguese king. And he was very interested in exploring the African coast, especially, and looking at new routes across the Atlantic. He was also trying to find out, really, along the sort of coastal exploration of Africa, the trade routes across the Sahara. So the Arabic people of the Mediterranean, especially, had control of this. He wanted to know where the gold came from and how they could essentially intercept this trade in both slaves and gold. He's also credited with developing a new ship, the caravel, which was lighter and faster and could sail into the wind, which was part of the sort of key here to this discovery. And he wanted then to sort of continue this Atlantic exploration. So he sent various captains and seafarers out, which resulted in Madeira. We heard about you talk about Madeira wine and Madeira, Richard, which was discovered in 1418, the Azores in 1431. And then he moved down the Western African Cape because nobody had really gone down that far. And there was a lot of myths about what they could discover. As a part of that, he hired a Venetian seafarer called Cadamosto, who first saw these islands in 1456. But there was a bit of a disagreement on discovery. And I fell down a little bit of a rabbit hole in what was essentially defined as a discovery. How do you discover it? Is it the first person who saw the island or did you have to go on land? So apparently Henry the Navigator's definition was you had to leave behind artifacts and you also had to prove your ability to return. This first sort of discovery didn't cover any of those bases, really. So the credit goes to a Genoese explorer called Donoli, who was commissioned by Henry in 1460. We then have somebody else called Diego Alfonso, who explored it further and named the different islands after saints for the day of discovery. So we have Santa Lucia, for example, was discovered on the 13th of December, and Santo Antonio on the 17th of January 1462. So after that point, the islands were settled quite quickly. In 1461, we have Santiago, which is the biggest island with the first settlement. There was actually the first European settlement in all of sub-Saharan Africa, sort of that point. And different islands had different purposes. So Fogo was for the colonial townspeople. There was a leper island. And then they started earning the right to keep slaves. Started quite small first. In 1510, there were 30 slaves, rising to 14,000 in 1580. So this really becomes key to the economic reason, really, for the Cape Verde Islands. Portugal gained exclusive rights to the Western African slave trade in 1466, which, again, just caused this to be hugely profitable as a place for people to go to. Exported cane sugar and rum, typical things, supplying other ships as well. So it was initially quite good, but because there were so many pirates, so many raids coming, various different people, this actually led to a huge economic decline. And talking of those, actually, I found a link. So you're in North Carolina trials, and I found a link between Cape Verde and North Carolina, which got to do with Drake, actually. And Drake, who came here as part of his raiding activities, really, in the 1580s. So he went in 1585 with a ship from Plymouth going into the Atlantic. He was going to the Caribbean, really, but stopped off in Cape Verde and raided and sacked and plundered Santiago, the main island here, on the 17th of November that year. And after that, he decided to go to North Carolina afterwards. That was his next stop, to the Roanoke settlement. So he was going from one to the other. But really, this was, I suppose, the foundation of the Cape Verde Islands, and economic decline continued. There were lots of problems because of lack of resources and the climate as well. Into the 18th century, things were not going well at all. Recovery began again in the late 18th century, and slave trade was prohibited in the Northern Hemisphere in 1815. England earned the right to trade with Portugal and Brazil. There was coffee cultivated here. Again, a little bit of a sort of boost until they had to start to diversify. Salt started being produced. So this island here that I'm on, Sal, was a huge one on salt production. There's an amazing crater a bit further north, a sort of extinct volcano that's got a salt lake at the center of it, which used to export vast quantities of salt, which was mainly going not to Europe, actually, some of it to France in the 20th century. But before that, most of it went to Brazil, actually. But after that, again, when slavery was abolished, there wasn't really much here anymore. It's too far away to export anything. The Portuguese hadn't invested in the land at all, so agriculture wasn't particularly beneficial. So cultivation was really, really difficult. So it was a difficult place to live in, I think, for a very long time, until the 1950s, when it became an overseas province and started on the road to independence. The country became independent in 1975. There was a man called Amical Cabral, who was the key to all of this. And he was one of the people who had founded the African Party for Independence of Guinea and the Cape Verdes. Together, they were essentially really campaigning for independence. And since then, again, it's been a relatively tricky time for the Cape Verdeans, I think, but it's now the tourist industry that properly keeps it going. But you've been here as well, haven't you, Richard?
I have. I'm a big fan. Actually, partly because it's a great way of getting a bit of winter sun, really. And also because it has a form of music called morna, which is the distinctive Cape Verdean music. And one of my favourite singers ever was a woman called Cesaria Évora from Cape Verde, who was a morna singer, who I came across in Paris, I think it was, and then became such a fan, I rather followed her around, but she died in 2011. But it's a wonderful music. It's a mixture of sort of Portuguese fado with African elements to it too, sung in Cape Verdean Creole. But it's incredibly beautiful. It has embodied this notion of saudade, which is a kind of longing, a bit like the hiraeth of Welsh culture. And I think it's because there's such a big Cape Verdean diaspora, is that any diaspora culture has that kind of notion of longing for home built into it. And you hear the music and it is incredibly beautiful. And she was wonderful, wonderful singer. That's why he got me interested in Cape Verde when I went for the first time. Loved it.
I came across it, Kat, actually, and not Drake, but Prince Rupert of the Rhine, who was this great dashing cavalier in the English Civil Wars, because he ended up leading the remains of the Royalist fleet in sort of perpetual revolution against Parliament once it had got rid of Charles I by beheading him, etc. And they stopped off at Cape Verde for some, I think it was goats and wild boar. So provisions, really. And then headed, he and his six ships, that's all he had left, they headed to Barbados, thinking that would be a good place because it was still royalist. But luckily, the navigator got his bearings wrong and they ended up in St. Lucia, because Barbados was by then parliamentarian. So they would have been captured or killed. So that was a lucky navigational mistake.
I had no idea that Prince Rupert ended up sailing round the Atlantic. I had no idea at all. Fascinating.
Yeah, he became basically an admiral and then a pirate, and really was the last surviving royalist force. And it was pursued all around the place by the parliamentarian navy, which was incredibly powerful, but he got away. His brother, sadly, Prince Maurice, died in a shipwreck during a storm and never to be seen Prince Rupert spent many, many years looking for him, but he disappeared. But Prince Rupert survived.
Invites speculation, doesn't it, about the parents, that they called their boys Rupert and Morris?
Well, they were German, so it was Ruprecht and Moritz, so maybe that's better.
Charles, I believe you have a selection of middle names, and among them is Morris, am I right?
You're right, Richard, thank you. Yes, it's my third name and one I don't talk about very much, actually.
That's why he keeps bringing it up.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Blushing in North Carolina.
Amazing. Do you want to hear my favourite fact?
Yes, yeah. Please.
So that was just a little quirky fact of today's Cape Verde life, actually. I did a sort of tour with a brilliant guy called Nani, actually, who took us around the island and lived in the capital of Sal, which is Espargos. And he told us about the postal service there. So it's quite a nice town. It's very brightly coloured. All the houses are painted in different colours. So apparently there's a sort of unwritten rule that you're not allowed to paint it the same colour as your neighbour. So you always have to do something different, something brighter and better. But the houses don't have numbers or names. So you do have streets, but you have no other way of identifying them. So it's all about the design of the colour. And because it's done so tricky, they don't deliver post to your house. So you have to go to the post office to do that. But if you were going to try to get anyone to come to it, you would have to describe it by the colour or by the appearance. There's a good way of incentivizing some good designs on the houses. And if you've ordered a parcel or something like that, you would just have to go to the nearest, you'd describe in the delivery bits online the nearest big landmark, or it could be a petrol station or a shop or a house that you can recognise or something like that. And when the parcel delivery driver arrives, he'll call you and say, I'm here, and then you have to come and get it. So quite a different system. So I think we're going to move on then. Richard, you're up next this week, and you've been looking into Lincoln Cathedral.
Step with me, if you will, to the plashy fenlands of the east of England in the Middle Ages, in what we now call Lincolnshire. Imagine making your way through that most inhospitable landscape. All is dark and damp and swampy and marshy and boggy. And then all of a sudden you see before you, standing on its crag, the most magnificent sight available to the Middle Ages, probably Lincoln Cathedral, standing on its crag above the city. And what you would see if you were doing it between 1312 and 1548 was the tallest building in the world, taller than the Great Pyramid of Giza. And it would have remained the tallest building in the world until the construction of the Eiffel Tower. But unfortunately, the spire blew down in a storm in 1548. But nonetheless, even without its spire, there were two spires on the Western Towers as well. They came down in 1807. It's still the most magnificent building. Why? Because of the power and prestige of the Diocese and Bishop of Lincoln. The Diocese of Lincoln stretched from the Humber to the Thames at its greatest extent, which made the Bishop of Lincoln one of the richest and most powerful potentates, not only in England, but in Christendom. So Lincoln Cathedral really got going. There was a Roman city there, Lindum, of significance, of strategic value because of that crag, I guess. And then after the conquest, one of William the Conqueror's pals, a bloke called Remy, was rewarded with the bishopric of Lincoln. The church was then at Dorchester on Thames. As I said, it was a huge diocese from the Thames to the Humber. And for strategic reasons, and also because he wanted to centre it in the wealthiest part of England, Remy, by then Remigius, first Bishop of Lincoln of that era, re-established his cathedral church in Lincoln. The first cathedral, a classic kind of Anglo-Norman Romanesque building, went up. Well, I think it was consecrated in 1092, but unfortunately Remigius died 2 days before the consecration. Unfortunate timing. And a bit of that is preserved in the West Front, where you still see these massive Norman arches with chevron decoration. But they are set within a screen, an enormous screen, and beyond that, this enormous cathedral, which was built really in three principal stages, although every medieval building of note is a story about things falling down and being rebuilt. After Remigius came the most famous Bishop of Lincoln, St. Hugh of Lincoln, originally Hugh of Avalon, who was a Carthusian monk from Burgundy. But being a Carthusian, he moved around a bit within the Carthusian world. That brought him to England. He was a man of enormous gifts and also well connected. And so he was elected Bishop of Lincoln. And then there was in a bit of a state because in 1185, there was an earthquake, one of the worst earthquakes that ever afflicted England. And the whole thing fell down. Charles.
Sorry, to go back to Saint Hugh of Lincoln, why did he become a saint?
I can tell you why. Partly because he built substantially the cathedral that followed after it fell down in 1185.
Around
1200, he really got engaged with that. He was an extraordinary man, a man of extraordinary gifts and vision. He was the one who famously went to visit some monks in a monastery in Normandy and there asked if he might venerate the arm of Mary Magdalene. That was the relic in their position. And he knelt and venerated and then bit off the finger and took it home because he needed to stock his cathedral with relics in order, you know, to put it on the map, so to speak. He was a great builder, and a big chunk of the cathedral we see today was down to him. And the reason he was doing that was because Lincoln was so fabulously rich. And the reason Lincoln was fabulously rich was, of course, the cloth, the wool and the cloth trade, which built so many magnificent churches in the east of England, none more magnificent than Lincoln Cathedral. Hugh, famously, his best friend was a swan. And the swan used to walk around with him and would also protect him from anyone who was giving him a hard time. So Hugh and the swan became a thing. And you will see in Lincoln today at the Shrine of St. Hugh references to swans. My favourite fact, well, it's not my favourite, it's one of my favourite facts about Lincoln. He built St. Hugh's Choir. So the church, as I say, there was an original cathedral and then they expanded it and then they expanded it. And St. Hugh's great contribution was St. Hugh's Choir. And the thing that's most spectacular about St. Hugh's Choir, I think, is the vaulting. So English Gothic, famous for its vaults, a technology that really was advanced by masons. They might have been French masons, they might have been English masons, but certainly English Gothic played a huge part of that. St. Hugh's Vault is my favourite vault of any ecclesiastical building, indeed any building in the world. It's called the Crazy Vault. And the reason for that is it's irregular. It is asymmetrical. It has a tiercerum, which is a sort of decorative rib that doesn't really do anything but disrupts the absolute symmetrical pattern of the vault. And if you look up at it, it's completely mad, but also completely compelling. And it gives this extraordinary rhythm to the ceiling. Some have said that it resembles a swan taking flight. And there's something about it that does indeed lift the building, a building which is all about vertical, English Gothic being that, narrow lancet windows. And of course, the three stages of its exterior walls. There's a sort of ground stage, then above that, the triforium. You'll see this in Westminster Abbey too. Then above that, the clerestory, which was another great invention, really came from Bernard of Clairvaux, the Cistercian abbot and also builder of monasteries, who believed that light was the divine essence. And so he developed an architecture that allowed more windows to be put into church buildings so light could flood in. To gather light in the cathedral was to gather the goodness of God. And so you have all that happening. It has two transepts, very unusual, but that's because it was built over a long period of time. And in the big transept, the main transept, you have two of the great rose windows, not commonly found in English Gothic architecture, but the two finest of all are at Lincoln, the Dean's Eye and the Bishop's Eye. On the north transept, you have the Dean's Eye, which is made with plate tracery, about 1230, I think, and full of wonderful original medieval stained glass. It's a huge thing. And then on the other side, built about 100 years later, is the Bishop's Eye, which is done with curvilinear tracery. It's a completely different thing. And if you look at it, it's just full of these extraordinary curves creating leaf shapes. It's absolutely beautiful. The Dean's Eye looked out on the north side towards darkness, and the Dean's job was to protect the cathedral from the forces of darkness that gathered. The Bishop's Eye looked to the south, to the light, again, that notion of light, towards the goodness of God. The idea was that the cathedral would be in itself a kind of model of heaven and hell. When Hugh died and was canonised, of course, it became a great centre of pilgrimage. And that, of course, brought yet more money and revenue into the cathedral. So the cathedral was partly built that you might experience in this earth not only the heaven that awaited you, but also the hell that would await you if you'd been a naughty boy. And as you made your way around the cathedral, those reminders of heaven and hell and the essential choice we have to make between goodness and perdition would be borne in upon the pilgrim. In the nave, of course, are people who were unlettered, done with stained glass and incredibly rich and vivid carving. And at the east end of the church, you got towards the bit where educated, literate people, that was done through text and word and liturgy. an extraordinary building, extended at the end as well. It has some unusual features. For example, it has a lovely cloister. Now, cloisters, of course, you associate mostly with Benedictine monasteries, but there was never a Benedictine community at Lincoln. It also has a chapter house, again, associated with Benedictine communities, but never Benedictine community at Lincoln. So nobody really knows what that was about. Perhaps they saw them and they liked them. Notoriously at Lincoln, of course, you also have the shrine of Little St. Hugh. There are two St. Hughes associated with Lincoln. St. Hugh of Lincoln, previously Hugh of Avalon, great saint, and then Little St. Hugh, never a saint, and also a very dark period in that cathedral's history, and indeed in English history. 1255, an eight-year-old boy went missing and was found in a well, murdered. And the accusation fell on the Jews of Lincoln. Jews were in Lincoln because in the medieval system, Christians were not allowed to lend money at interest. So for the purposes of finance, Jews were permitted because they were able to. But of course, that meant Jews controlled the loan books. And if it became possible for you to get rid of your Jews and therefore to tear up your loan book, then you wouldn't have to pay them back. So that's one of the reasons why anti-Semitism motored along so much in medieval England, was because of that. Stories began to emerge that the Jews had killed this boy and then first tortured him and then crucified him. It's a blood libel. You see them, there's one in Norwich too. And as a result, the Jews, 90 Jews from Lincoln, were rounded up and taken to the Tower of London. And I'm afraid 18 were hanged. Not long after, in the 1290s, of course, Edward I expelled the Jews from England. A recurring issue, you know, if you're looking for somebody to other, then Jewish communities provide very often a target for your anxiety and hostility and antipathy. So that's there too. Various other burials of people of note. Catherine Swinford or Swineford, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Charles, your period, not mine. The wife, originally mistress of John of Gaunt. And then, I mean, the magnificence of the building is very, very hard to overstate. It has a wonderful library by Sir Christopher Wren that was built in 1674, replacing a medieval library. It is an extraordinary place. Not only is it magnificent, not only is the architecture incredibly fine, the decoration inside, there's a pulpitum, a screen that separates the nave from the choir and the sanctuary. And it's one of the most extraordinary pieces of carving you will see anywhere in the world. On one side, your pilgrim would make your way through the pulpitum where you would see heaven and hell in this extraordinary elaborate display. If you look behind you when you go through, the rear wall is blank. It's show business, right? You're making your way around the building towards the shrine of St. Hugh. The other thing about it, which I think is so impressive, it's made from local stone. In fact, Lincoln Cathedral still has a quarry at nearby Risholm where they quarry the stone for repairs. Lincolnshire limestone is limestone, obviously, so it carves beautifully, but it also has quite high iron oxide, which gives us this buttery, yellowy, sometimes almost gold sheen to it too. So when the sun catches it, it is a truly wonderful thing and a magnificent testament to the power and the witness of the gospel in that part of it. I was ordained in Lincoln Cathedral, so I should express a kind of connection. But I remember going to the deathbed of a guy who'd been a tail end Charlie and Lancasters in the Second World War that flew out from RAF Waddington, which is just on the other side of the hill, if you see what I mean. And he told me once that he'd been on, I mean, he'd done a horrendous 50 missions, I think. And he came back from one bombing at night cities in northern Germany. He'd been devastated by this experience. It was horrendous, completely brutalised by it. And he said he remembered at dawn going in a wagon and seeing Lincoln Cathedral light up. And he said he saw angels flying round the tower of Lincoln Cathedral. So I think it's a building of extraordinary symbolic force. Ruskin described it as the loveliest building in England and worth to any other cathedrals you'd care to mention. I agree, actually, but it's a very, very contentious thing to say. There have been major fallouts between me and the former Dean of Durham, who makes the case for Durham Cathedral, others for York Minster. Everyone has their favourite cathedral. But I think Lincoln really is quite exceptional and probably, well, for me, definitely the most beautiful building in England. Would you like a favourite fact?
Yes, please.
Well, the Chapter House of Lincoln, which is one of the finest you'll find anywhere, it's on the northeast end of the cathedral. And traditionally, it's where the monks, who would have been part of the community, and then the cathedral canons would gather and they would sit round, and it's got a single pillar in the middle, and then a wonderful vault that comes out from it, and then this large circular, where it's actually 10-sided, building with seats against the wall where all the canons would sit and discuss what they needed to discuss. Interesting, one of them scratched a 9-men Morris grid by his seat, because obviously it got so dreary in some of those meetings that him and his mate would play 9-men's Morris as business was transacted. But you'll know it if you have seen The Da Vinci Code. For in 2006, it was filmed, a bit of it, in the Chapter House at Lincoln Cathedral, standing in for Westminster Abbey. Westminster Abbey refused permission because they thought The Da Vinci Code was not a brand with which they wanted to be associated. The Dean and Chapter of Lincoln had no such scruples, so they decided to film it there. And they mocked up the tomb of Isaac Newton from polystyrene to make it look like Westminster Abbey. And Mr. Tom Hanks, you'll record, played the principal part as the symbologist, whatever that is, called to try to solve the mystery of the Da Vinci Code. And Mr. Hanks, while he was filming there, brought his two boys, who then I think were aged about 9 and 11. And as you can imagine, while he was getting on with filming the nonsense in the Chapter House, the boys needed to be amused. So the Dean's Verger told them to go and find the cat and the mouse. Lincoln is full of famous carvings. The Lincoln Imp, very famous, is in the Angel Choir. So he sent these two boys off to find the cat and the mouse carving. And they came back and they said, "We found it." And he said, "Where?" And they said, "Over there." He said, "You're not even warm." Because the cat and the mouse carving he was thinking of was the famous one. Tom Hanks' boys discovered another cat and mouse carving that nobody knew about. So the inquiring mind of young Master Hanks and the other young Master Hanks had found a whole new carving of a cat eating a mouse in Lincoln Cathedral. There you go.
I love that.
I like that. Yes.
I love that you're even talking about this, because one of the things we all have to do as authors is go around the country talking at festivals, at literary festivals and that sort of thing. And I didn't know, I'd never been to Lincoln until invited there for a literary festival. And that's how I came across the cathedral. So I know as authors, we often complain about how tedious it is to have to set off for 3 hours to go and sell 10 books or whatever. But occasionally you do come across a gem. And that's why I was introduced to Lincoln. And I do think it's the most beautiful building I've seen in England too.
Do you know it, Kat?
I do. I haven't been inside, but I have been outside because there's lots of Vikings in Lincoln as well before that. And they've got ice skates. When we talked about ice skates the other week, there's Viking ice skates in Lincoln as well. So there's got this big Viking history. So that's my main bit. So this is a bit later, but I've walked around it many times and I do agree it's lovely. It's the whole town is beautiful.
It's a very good pie shop as well. Famous pie shop on Steep Hill. And above it lived for a while T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. It also has the finest organ in England, I think, Lincoln Cathedral organ, which was built by Father Willis, the last cathedral organ he built, 1898, I think it was. And it was the first one to be powered by electricity, but unfortunately, they hadn't actually built the power station. So on the opening concert in 1898, they couldn't power it with electricity because there's nothing to plug it into. So they had some burly lads from the Lincolnshire Regiment come and pump it instead. But eventually it did get its electric.
That's so good.
I love that. So good. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Richard. That's excellent. I'm going to have to go inside next time I go. So moving then on finally to you, Charles, and you have been researching bank robberies this week.
I have, you know, from cathedrals to cathedrals of capitalism that get broken open. And I wanted to start, because I did mention it last week, that I knew of a Norwegian bank robbery. And it was 20 years ago, pretty much to the day, actually, when the police in Norway were alerted in Stavanger that there was going to be this big bank robbery. But it was going to be Easter. So they decided they weren't going to take it too seriously. They didn't bring in reinforcements or whatever. So these heavily armed Norwegian bank robbers appeared, wearing, of course, ski masks to disguise themselves in a very Norwegian way. And they broke in through this bulletproof glass. It wasn't bulletproof. They fired 130 bullets into the glass and it duly broke. And they got away with what was the kroner equivalent of $10 million then. Nearly all of it still outstanding because the police couldn't get out. The few police there were blocked in the police station because these very nefarious people doing the bank robbery set a car on fire at the exit to the police station, so the Norwegian police couldn't get out. So yes. I don't know. It's called the Nokas Stavanger bank robbery, but I just thought it was full of Norwegian tropes, and I quite enjoy all that.
Charles, is there any evidence that they packed their rucksacks carefully before they executed this robbery?
Well, I think the bank robbers did, but the police didn't. That's where all the chaos ensued. They'd left the bits that they didn't need on the top, and that was obviously the big mistake.
Done their
the
homework.
Handcuffs.
Yes. There's a film about it, actually. It's quite a good film. So you
oh, really?
Watch it.
Yeah. Of course, no bank robbery is funny, so there we are. But going back to the very first bank robbery recorded one is the Bank of Pennsylvania robbery in 1798. And it was the first one in the US history. And it's quite an interesting sort of look at American culture even back then. So in August 1798, a man called Isaac Davis made off with $160,000. He was a member of the Carpenters Company, and they were the guild that owned and rented out the bank. And he had some keys. So with the help of the porter at the bank, he managed to access the money, and he only came under suspicion when he suddenly deposited huge amounts of money into various other banks. But before that, a man called Patrick Lyon, who had arrived in the US from Scotland and set himself up as a blacksmith, he had changed the locks at the bank, so he was the initial suspect. And the authorities would have none of his protestations. They didn't hear them at all. They chucked him into prison. This was during a yellow fever epidemic breaking out in that area. And poor Lyons was left with his hair falling out, sick with yellow fever, innocent, until the actual man, Davis, started splashing his money around and he was arrested. Even when Davis was arrested, he didn't get into any trouble. And I say, I'm afraid this is slightly American. He got off pretty much because his uncle was the powerful judge and said that it wasn't really a prisonable offence. And this poor Mr. Lyon, the Scot, improperly prisoned, was kept in prison far too long, even when he was known to be innocent. But anyway, there was a good payoff there. He eventually got $9,000 in compensation. I'm going to jump ahead a bit now to the Baker Street robbery that took place in London in 1971. So the Lloyds Bank in Baker Street had got fed up with so many false alarms because there was a lot of roadworks nearby. So they turned off their alarm system. And a man who found out about this, Anthony Gavin, he decided to do something, a crime that he'd always wanted to perform, in homage to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. He's back with us. He had loved a story by Conan Doyle called The Red-Headed League. And that features a group of men attempting to rob a bank vault by digging a tunnel underneath it from a nearby building. Anyway, this man, Anthony Gavin, he's a career criminal. He decided to do this while the alarms were down in the bank. And do you know the most extraordinary thing about this, really, is that a radio enthusiast, an amateur radio enthusiast, Mr. Robert Rowlands, heard the robbers talking to each other on walkie-talkies while they were digging into the Lloyds Bank in Baker Street. And he rang the police and told them this was going on. The police didn't take it at all seriously. So he used a cassette recorder to record these conversations. And eventually the police believed them, but still didn't turn up in time. And the Baker Street robbery ended up with £3 million being got away. But this is the joy of the criminal mind. The police eventually found the burglars because the man who had been told to go and secure the property a few doors down, Benjamin Wolfe, signed the lease in his own name. So they were all caught and rounded up. So that was unfortunate. There's another one. I quite like this because it brings in sort of shady people from the 70s and beyond. Was the United California bank robbery from 1972. There was a gang of robbers who wanted to steal $30 million that they believed was inside this bank, not just because they wanted the money, although, of course, that was the prime movement behind what they did, was because they heard that this was really dark money, that it had been paid by people representing Jimmy Hoffa. Basically, it was bribe money to President Nixon to pardon Jimmy Hoffa. And it's true that in 1971, so the year before this bank robbery, Jimmy Hoffa had his sentence commuted by Nixon. So there's possible, you know, serious intent behind this. We end up with this place being targeted. According to Barber, one of the main criminals involved, he actually said, you know, Nixon's not one of our favourite people to begin with. We were told he was hiding some money, so we decided to target it. They really did plan this one very carefully, but unfortunately, again, they left some fingerprints behind. But it did take the FBI 8 years to discover the baddies and apprehend them and put them in prison. The most spectacular bank robbery I came across was in Iraq. The Central Bank of Iraq was robbed in March 2003, and the robbers got away with nearly $1 billion, which was a quarter of the country's currency reserves. And this was actually done by Qusay Hussein, the son of the Iraqi dictator Saddam, who turned up with three trucks and told the bank to load it up. And so they basically did exactly as they were told. And it's thought the robbery took place after it became known that the US invasion of Iraq would begin the next day. And although the US troops, when they broke into Hussein's palace, they found $650 million. The rest has never been located. So I don't know. There's been so many in the UK. If you want to look at the hubs of bank robberies, it's California. Weirdly, for the size of state, Colorado has a particularly high number of them. The one I wanted to go was to further afield, which was the Banco Central robbery in Brazil in 2005, where a group got in, stole all these containers of 50 real notes with an estimated value of about $72 million back then, you know, 20 years ago. And again, 3 months before the robbery took place, the group rented a commercial property in the center of the city and they tunneled through and they made the tunnel and they lined it with wood and plastic and lighting and put in air conditioning. Five men were arrested, but the other 18 who were suspects in this major operation of construction and robbery, they seem to have got away altogether. The supposed leader of the robbery, a man called Luis Fernando Ribeiro, was kidnapped and held for ransom. And even though his family paid the ransom of $890,000, he was murdered and his body was left outside on the road. And the New York Times have said that, in fact, the Brazil prosecutors believed that this was just revenge by Brazil police officers. They couldn't prove their cases against these people, so they bumped off the ringleader. My favourite part of all these bank robberies is really, I want to end on the whole idea that the bank robbers never really think it through. They may be good at the robbery part, but the other bits don't go very well. And this is the Dunbar armed robbery, and this was done in downtown LA in 1972. The 70s seemed to have been a rich time for these bank robberies. Anyway, they stole $18.9 million. You could double that for today's value. It's basically the largest cash robbery in the US until March this year. And they left no evidence. There were six robbers who left no evidence. But then, sadly, 2 years later, one of the robbers, a man called Eugene Lamar Hill Jr., went to buy a house and he chucked the real estate broker all of these bundles of banknotes, unfortunately, still in the original currency straps.
What an idiot.
And yeah, they all got rounded up, the six of them, and they got up to 24 years each. And I think that's where I want to end because having a bit of fun with this subject of bank robbers and bank robberies, but at the end of the day, they got their just desserts.
I know an even more rubbish one, actually, Charles. There's a priest. It went a bit wrong in his life. He's in Poland, a fellow called Father Norbert something. I can't remember his surname. This was in 2009. And he decided to rob the bank, like you do. So he went in and he held someone at knife point and he absconded with about £1,000 from the bank. But unfortunately, he hadn't arranged any getaway. So he waited for a bus to make his getaway and was immediately arrested and went to jail. So again, you need to think these things through, don't you?
Yes, you've got to have... It's not just the getting the money. That's what they don't seem to remember. The getting the money is the first bit, not the easiest bit. But once you've done that, you have to have a follow-up to the plan, really.
Yeah. I was at this thing, sat next to a police officer who was responsible for policing cybercrime. And she told me that the smart bank robbers, because what they don't do is knock the door down and hold people up at gunpoint, but they hack into a bank system and they perhaps cream off just a few pence here and there, but a few pence from thousands, tens of thousands, 100,000, millions of customers, and nobody notices, or they don't really notice it. And if you do notice it, they're incredibly hard to go after because they convert it into cryptocurrency, whatever. And I said, well, can't you develop systems to keep up with these people? And he said, no, they're getting so good at it, and it's so richly, lavishly rewarded. They've kind of run ahead of the pack, and now it's very hard to catch them at all. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that's where most bank robberies happen now, or where most money is lost from banks.
I was going to say also, I mean, surely banks don't keep that much cash anymore, do they? Do they?
Well, there aren't any banks. It's very hard to find a bank, isn't it?
That cop I sat next to, she told me something interesting as well, is that they're so organised now and so deep into crypto that there's a 24-hour helpline that you can phone if you're a crypto bank robber, if you've got a problem kind of with your computer or something. Literally 24-hour helpline, you can phone up and they'll talk you through your illegal transaction.
Well, they don't do that at NatWest. So
no, better.
Your business is important to us.
Yes.
I need to change banks, I think. Yes. Brilliant. Thanks for that, Giles. That was very good. I think our disembodied voice has got something to say.
Yes, I've just got a couple of clarifications. So the Carpenters Company that Isaac Davis was a part of, they owned and rented out Carpenters Hall to businesses, including the Bank of Pennsylvania. So Davis had a link to the bank in that respect. And then he worked with the porter to get in, as Charles said. And law claims that burglars who burgled the United California Bank were caught after leaving fingerprints in the dishwasher of the home that they rented. But I think it's probably more realistic that somebody at the FBI received a tip-off.
Brilliant. So then, it's time. Our disembodied voice is going to announce the winner of this week's episode to see where our Warren trophy is going to go this week.
Well, I'm sure Warren would like to go to the Cape Verde Islands, but I imagine you might be home before then, Kat. But we're still going to give it to you this week.
Yay!
Well done.
Thank you very much. Maybe I should just take him back, just for his sake, not for mine.
Thank you for giving us this valuable beach time, Kat. I must say, it's very nice of you to be inside on splendid
day. I hope you appreciate it. I'm sweating in a corner when I should be lying on the beach.
Is it really hot? Tell us a bit more about that. Is it super hot?
It's not that bad. It's actually quite nice. It's like 25 degrees. There's a bit of a breeze. It's
perfect.
The sea is just clear and clean, and I'm not working for the tourist board, I promise, but I would definitely recommend
and
it.
And is that it? Is it sort of one of those constant climate type places that it's always lovely?
It's pretty much all year. There's hardly any rain. The wind is quite strong here. So they do a lot of surfing and kite surfing, apparently. They're sort of champion kites. I went to see them the other day. It's amazing. So that's the biggest problem, actually, is the wind. But it feels pretty perfect. So.
Oh, how lovely.
Are you staying in that hotel run by the Italian man who's got a dachshund?
I'm not, no, but I'd like to meet him. There's a lot of building projects. We went to see one. We drove past one. There's a lot of building projects here that start and don't finish. So you have all these sort of ghost towns almost. So there was an Italian hotel that started about 20 years ago and it was never completed. It's a weird architecture, in the middle of nowhere, near one of the beaches, and just nothing. So it's a bizarre one. Hopefully not that one. Right, but before we go, we're going to have to do some more homework for next week. We can't just be off on holiday. So for next week's episode, Richard, you're going to be looking into parchment.
Yes.
And Charles, you're staying on robberies in a way, sort of, but a different type. So you're going to go with Robin Hood.
Oh, yes. Good.
And I'm staying in, I suppose, sort of slightly tropical territories, and I'm going to be researching the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, it's a very good combo.
Yeah, I think so. Let's see if anyone can get Arthur Conan Doyle in again. I think that should be our sort of aim now, is just to try to get him into an episode.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. I think parchment's got a good chance. I think Robin Hood stretching it a bit.
Bermuda Triangle, though, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Brilliant. Let's see. So that's it for this week. So we have to say thank you to all our brilliant listeners. And please do subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Leave us a review because it really helps people find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. And we absolutely love reading them as well. So thank you for all our lovely reviews so far. If you'd like to suggest a new topic for us to look into, you can send us an email. Just write to rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So in the words from Richard Adams' Watership Down, daylight, even when the sun is clear of clouds, seems to us simply the natural condition of the earth and air. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.